Welcome to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. It's time to gather the Dakota political junkies around the table. This is our rotating panel of some of the most experienced and insightful political journalists working in the state of South Dakota today. With us first is John Hunter. He is publisher of the Madison Daily Leader. John, welcome to In the Moment.
Great. Thanks, Lori.
Nice to have you here. And then also with us, we have Jonathan Ellis from Sioux Falls calling in with the Argus Leader Media. Jonathan, thanks for being here as well.
Hey, Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you, too. Gee, whatever will we talk about today?
No shortage.
John Hunter, let's start with you, and let's start with the State of the State address. Was there something that you want to kick off with that really jumped out to you from the governor's comments yesterday that resonates?
Well, certainly his announcement that Amazon would start collecting and remitting sales tax in South Dakota surprised me. That's not something I even had on my radar. Maybe others did. So that surprises most, especially as we are kind of as a preview saying these online sales are getting to be a bit of a problem for the South Dakota budget, and the fact that online-only retailers are not collecting and remitting sales tax, and our local merchants are. Mm. And then just a few months after that, or even less than that, then all of a sudden here comes a possible solution, at least a step in the right direction. So, yeah, it was a big surprise, and I think good news for South Dakota and good news for its citizens and its retailers. I think it's a great way to kick off the year.
It's also time to clean out your Amazon shopping cart. If you're part of the problem, then it's time to get caught up because, the freebie is over now.
John, as of February 1st.
As of February 1st, you got a couple weeks to clean out your shopping cart. John Hunter, what's the potential impact for, a town like Madison and the retailers there of, because Amazon doesn't just sell books anymore.
Right. Yes, it's certainly a complete retailer in a lot of senses, and they do all sorts of things. And this has been a problem for local retailers in communities all over America. And I think most of them, and I included, think it's been an unfair tax advantage that online only businesses have won, and they've been able to take business away from local businesses, which contribute to our communities in a lot of different ways. So I think there's a fairness issue. We've been fighting it a long time. I think, this doesn't solve all of it, but maybe having someone of this stature make that change helps.
Jonathan Ellis, it does seem like a pretty significant mark in the win column for Governor Dennis Dugard, no?
I would say it's very significant, given the fact that the state is sort of spearheading a lawsuit to overturn a 1992 Supreme Court ruling on sales tax issues. And, we're very dependent on a sales tax, more so than the vast majority of other states, because we don't have an income tax. And so for people to find ways to sort of flout the tax system, that makes life difficult for state and local governments that have to provide basic sources, basic needs. And the governor, not to overlook, but the governor also indicated that because of the soft farm economy, that revenues are much lower than even they expected initially. So, I think the Amazon announcement will hopefully, from their perspective, provide a boost at a time when they really needed it.
Let's talk about ethics now. And Jonathan Ellis, let's stick with you because you've written about this pretty extensively in just the last day or so since yesterday's State of the State. Give us an update about what the governor said and what was happening on the steps of the Capitol as well yesterday.
With regard to IM-22?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. There's no secret here that IM-22 is going to be repealed. And there were some protesters, about a dozen protesters at the Capitol yesterday to try to stop that. We're already seeing, and what I think will happen here, and I did write about this, is that there will be certain pieces of IM-22. It'll be a repeal and replace, and it will be replaced with I think from what some Republican leaders tell me, that there will be an ethics commission more than likely that will come out of this legislative session. So they will create some kind of an ethics commission. They have some sort of a blueprint for an ethics commission that existed back in the 1970s. Maybe they'll have, you know, that centered on campaign finance investigation. So maybe it'll be something like that. And then you see that the Secretary of State's office has a Senate bill now that's been submitted to deal with some campaign finance issues that were also dealt with in IM-22. So, you know, my guess is that there will be certain provisions of IM-22 or things that were in IM-22 that will come out of the legislative session. Certainly one of the things you will not see is any kind of publicly financed campaign mechanism, which IM-22 did have.
Those are the democracy credits of which we so frequently speak.
Correct, the democracy credits. I don't know of any lawmakers, at least within the majority of party, interested at all in instituting any kind of system like that here in South Dakota.
John Hunter, now I'm going to ask you the big question, because I know you're up for it. With no warning, I always ask John Hunter the really deep stuff. So this whole nation, this whole notion of folks from out of state coming in and influencing, you know, our ballot, our election, our laws, can you put that into context as to has that been an issue for a long time? Certainly, there's a fight brewing, you know, with ad purchases and the folks who supported IM-22 are not done supporting IM-22. So why does that matter that there's out of state money flowing in the state?
Well, it's a great question, and I think on many people's minds, how long has it been going on, and is it good or bad? And frankly, I don't think it's quite as bad as some people indicate it is. First, it has been going on a long time. I think there are, in a lot of cases, we don't know who finances elections until after they're over, but even election of candidates are certainly influenced by or help financed by out-of-state companies. So it has been going on a long time in a lot of different ways. Has it increased since Citizens United? I suppose it has. But it's not. I don't think it's quite as bad as we may think, because who holds the ultimate trump card? Sorry to use that word.
It's still a word, yeah.
who holds that thing? And that's the voter. The voter always wins at the end. I mean, And so only to the degree that people allow themselves to be influenced by advertising or opinion makers or blogs or whatever does this change. Ultimately, it gets back to one citizen, one vote in South Dakota, and we get to decide those laws. So, you know, for as far as these other organizations coming in and trying to persuade us, that's fine. We should try to recognize that for what it is. It's an organization that wants to persuade us. You make your own conclusion, read the kind of thing, and then make your decision. And that's, and they, you know, money doesn't necessarily win elections. The only thing it can do is influence the people who really do decide elections. That'll only happen if we allow it to happen.
Hmm. Jonathan Ellis, what's next? What else from the governor's state of the state is particularly on your mind today?
Well, I mean, to me, it was sort of standard Dennis Dugard. I mean, he's not an overwhelmingly, it was just, you know, standard Dennis Dugard speech, bread and butter, talked about, made fun of himself at times. I was kind of remarked, I mean, to me it was interesting that, you know, this is really kind of his last, I mean, he has one more state of the state, but that's sort of the handoff to the next governor. So this was kind of the last one that he'll do. As governor trying to get some business done in a legislative session. So that's somewhat remarkable. I think from my perspective, now it's time to just sit back and see what we get out of the legislature. There's always, as you know, to paraphrase Donald Rumsfeld, there's always sort of known unknowns that come out of, you know, so we'll see what kind of bills we get from lawmakers and what kind of controversies will stir up.
Sure. Transgender bathroom bill, Jonathan Ellis, that's something that the executive branch is not particularly interested, but there are some lawmakers who are.
There are some lawmakers who are, and of course there's also efforts to take that to a statewide vote, speaking of ballot issues, a statewide vote, and my guess is there'd be outside money involved in that as well. The governor's office ultimately, you know, the governor vetoed a bill on that last year, and it really, the issue sucked a lot of oxygen out of the room because it was so controversial. And I just don't see that the governor's office is really all that interested in replaying this issue again in this legislative session.
John Hunter, after we saw things that happened in other states and knowing that some lawmakers are still hearing from their constituents that they want the issue addressed, do you think transgender bathroom legislation has legs in peer this session?
I think actually a little less than last year, and that's I may be completely wrong, and that would not be the first time for that. But I think by observing what happens in other states where that's in some cases it becomes an issue that is almost unsolvable. It gets into details and then name-calling and all the kinds of worst kinds of possible politics that go into that. And some other states, of course, end up spending mountains of money on, which South Dakotans generally aren't interested in. And if they believe Governor Dugard, which says this is a solution, kind of looking for a problem, we don't seem to have a problem other than, people in peer bringing it up. So in some senses, I'm thinking that it may have less of an issue. Plus, you have the governor's likely veto weighing on the whole process, which we didn't have last year, where people are saying, "Yeah, this we're going to decide this," and then, but now they realize they have to have super majorities in both chambers to pull this off. And I just don't know if people want to put that much energy into this.
John Hunter, were there issues that were not addressed? Jonathan Ellis sort of alluded to the notion that we need to hear from the lawmakers as well. Were there things that you thought the governor didn't address that you expect to be highlights of this session?
Well, that's a good question. You did catch me off guard on that one. What he did not address. I think there are some fairly, maybe things that were under-addressed. You know, there certainly the meth, epidemic or the attack on that is going to be, as Jonathan kind of implied, that is going to come bubble up from the legislature rather than a plank for the governor. I think there'll be some other local government issues that will be brought up by either municipalities or counties and so forth that will have to be dealt with. So, I mean, this is kind of the surprise part of the legislature when bills are being introduced, and the governor has introduced his, and Secretary Krebs has hers, and Attorney General Jackley. So those are all the kind of predictable ones. Now comes the unpredictable portion, and that's sometimes for observers that's very interesting.
We spent the morning here on SDPB Public Radio listening to President-elect Donald Trump's press conference. It was an interesting interaction between the president-elect and the media in the room. A lot can be learned from that sort of, refused to answer take a question from CNN at one point, held reporters accountable for different things. They held him accountable for his tweets. Jonathan Ellis, do you have a notion of, are we looking at sort of a new era in how we communicate with President-elect Donald Trump? What did you notice from this morning at all?
Well, it was entertaining. he started the press conference out. I mean, I thought being somewhat complimentary of the press, I think a lot of reporters, and this is especially true of the Washington, they're very insular in their own little bubble, and I think that Trump being combative with the sort of elite media plays well with his supporters. I think he knows what he's doing. There's the big issue today, and this is going to be talked about within journalism communities, the ethics of this so-called intelligence briefing that has been put out that an internet organization published and CNN apparently published some parts. I mean, a lot of this stuff just plays in, I think, to the angst that the media has, I think a lot of this just plays into the supporters that Donald Trump have. So I think at the end of the day, it's very entertaining. Trump did not answer certain questions, especially the question near the end about whether he or his campaign had any interactions with Russia during the campaign. There are certainly questions about how he's going to distance himself from his business relationships. He had a lawyer come out and explain that. I'm not a trust expert, so I don't know too much about that. But it was this is it's going to be a wild ride, no doubt about it.
And John Hunter, he really dug into as well this notion of fake news, which maybe means something different to President-elect Trump than it does to other people. I'm not sure yet from listening to him today what exactly he meant by that. He talked about a moral compass for journalists. So I'm curious what you're thinking, you know, young journalists and journalists now. It seems like we're entering, I don't know, a new era of trying to pay attention here and get the facts right. And what are your thoughts there? Same as it ever was? Only?
Well, no, Lori, you're exactly right. It is, I think, a bit of a new era. And I think part of the biggest deal, and Jonathan hit the nail on the head, too, about these kind of newness of all this. And there have been some precedents for this kind of behavior before. But by and large, remember, you have a new president or a president-elect who has kind of no government experience whatsoever. He's never served on a local school board or in a state senate or a U.S. Senate or, you know, a representative or governor or any of those kinds of things. It's a pure business. And the business world is completely different from the public, sector. Remember, this is kind of a government by the people, for the people, of the people. And so businesses are not like that. They're owned by shareholders and they have different constituents. They have different rights and so forth. And I think all his instincts over his whole lifetime have led to this business model, and where you have the king on top, or they call him a CEO, and he pounds his fist on the desk and barks orders, and people do that, otherwise you fire him. And now he's entering in this thing where, remember, all the things that government does, being of the people, should be allowed for the people to see, and that's something he's not used to. And compromising with other branches of government, that's certainly not something he's used to. So now, whether he adapts over time, and he's probably had shown the ability to adapt to circumstances before, whether he adapts well or poorly is, I think, what we're going to see pretty fast in the next few months.
John Hunter is publisher of the Madison Daily Leader. John, I want to say thank you so much for being with us today. We always appreciate your time.
Thanks, Lori. I enjoyed it, too.
And Jonathan Ellis is with Argus Leader Media in Sioux Falls. Jonathan, always a pleasure as well. And follow you on Twitter. That's my advice to listeners.
Thanks, Lori. Appreciate it.
All right. Thanks a lot. After the break, South Dakota Department of Game, Fish and Parks Secretary Kelly Hepler. Stay in the moment. SDPB Radio. Welcome back to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. Kelly Hepler is Secretary of South Dakota Game, Fish, and Parks. He joins us now via phone to discuss the department's priorities for the upcoming legislative session. He's with us from Pierre. Secretary Helper, welcome to In the Moment.
Thank you. It's always a privilege to talk on public radio. We're one of your big supporters.
Well, thank you. It's nice to have you here, sir. And I'm wondering if you just want to start out with some of the legislative priorities for this session, and we'll go from there.
You know, it's interesting. This is one of those ones where we do not have an agency bill in front of the legislature. So we're still waiting, of course, to see what the legislature will bring in, the interest they have in GF&P. And typically this is, you know, we're a high image agency in the state. And so I'm sure some people will turn in some legislation. But one of our priorities, and this is one I know you've been talking about, I know you talked to Lieutenant Governor last week about, and that's, of course, this, you know, the whole discussion around the land exchange for Spearfish Canyon, Bismarck Lake, and, you know, potential establishment of a park later on.
Let's go into that, because I think I'm still trying to sort of suss out all the implications of that. Give us a quick overview first, and then we'll dig in from there.
Well, the intent right now is that within Spearfish Canyon, we presently have about 130 acres. We have, you know, three really important pieces of kind of the heart and soul of the area. We have Savoy Intake, we have Rough Lock Falls, and we have Spearfish Falls. These are iconic areas that people are very much aware of. And through time, starting in 2006 through 2014, you know, through the Spearfish Canyon Foundation and Homestake, we, you know, received those parcels. And we've really done a really nice job, and I think most people agree, going back and setting those up so people can use them without just loving it to death. They still have access, and they're still seeing the beauty of it without actually harming the environment. So that's a core sitting there. So that's one piece we're having a discussion on, and the contiguous land around that, it includes up to Little Spearfish Canyon, up to Tinton Road, and a little bit further, you know, downstream from Spearfish Falls, about 1,000 yards or so. There's about 1,600 acres in that parcel we were talking about, potentially getting that into state ownership.
Go ahead. No, you go ahead.
And the last piece is this Bismarck Lake, and that's, you know, the people who've used Custer State Park, particularly coming in from the Custer side, there's a small square there that belongs to the Forest Service, and people access that right now thinking they're actually in Custer State Park, but really they're on Forest Service land. So that's one, it makes sense, again, talking about being contiguous and less confusion about pulling that back in. So those two are the areas that we're talking about doing trades with some school and public lands and some of our own GFNP land with the federal government to get those back in state ownership.
Who do you need to hear from to really sort of move forward with that? Lieutenant Governor Matt Michaels said the funding is squared away and ready to make the next step. Who are the stakeholders here that you need to talk with yet?
You know, that's an excellent question, and I want to fall back this morning when I was driving in. I was listening to Cokie Roberts talk about the importance of news conferences, press conferences, and so when you go through those, you get a sense what people are thinking.
Mm-hmm.
And so this is really the back, who are the stakeholders? It's a broad, I mean, everybody in the state of South Dakota is a stakeholder in my eyes. But in particular, those people who live in Northern Hills, I spent last week visiting among sportsmen's group. There are some industry people there. But the one that probably resonated the most with me, I was on Thursday night, I was meeting in Senator Ewing's establishment in Spearfish, and there's 100-plus people there. And there are some people, I grew up in Spearfish, so there's people there that I knew forever and haven't seen forever. And listening to them, and just, you know, it was interesting to hear their concerns. And so I think the heart, at least personally, the heart for me is this. I want to make sure those people in Spearfish understand the things we're talking about is really for the long-term benefit of the South Dakota public and the benefit of Spearfish Canyon.
What's the vision for it? When you say the long-term benefit, paint me a picture of its potential.
Well, if you could, you know, of course, pictures are much better than what I'm going to be able to speak, is that, you know, it's there's nothing quite like it that I've been around as far as its beauty, the water we have, the clarity of the water, and those rock formations. If you can go back and you can look, and, you know, Homestake owned that land since the 1870s till early 2000s, so they're a long-term and very good. I mean, they ran that place with an iron fist, what they wanted. And so, but there's people who are getting access, for example, in Rough Lock Falls. You could walk under the falls. They could enter into the creek. And, you know, we have some shots we show in our slideshows to talk about paths down in the water. And they truly were. We're missing why we wanted it there. So we went back and fixed that up so people can still see the beauty. But they're going to stay out of the water so we can have, you know, their fish spawning. You can see the, you know, the beautiful waterfall. So that's what we're trying to do. I know there's all sorts of concerns out there, is that, you know, we're going to develop this. We're going to bring in a water park. We're going to build a, you know, a campground south of or downstream from Spearfish Falls. Those aren't true. I mean, there's a lot of history and a lot of concern. There's average person loves this park or loves this, you know, canyon area. And there's some tenants that came through public processes, through Homestake, and with the foundation that says we want public access, we want to maintain the beauty and integrity of this area, and that's exactly what we're looking for. We think that we're the best caretakers to be able to do that, so we have the capacity and we have the track record to be able to do that. And I'm not looking at a year from now, maybe even 2 years from now. I'm looking, where do we want to be in 30 years? And say, you know, we think we have the capacity to make sure what we're seeing right now is there 30 years from now.
What will be developed?
You know, I wouldn't use the word develop at all. Okay. I think that, you know, I know people throw that word out there, and development also has a special connotation in this conversation because there's a lot of, you know, there's a lot of points in these papers, that history that says we don't want development. Homestake has said that too. So I think what we've seen is a core. I mean, those three sites that I identified, that's a core of areas of improvement. But also, I think we can go back, and there's some trails we want to put along, you know, up out of the riparian areas, but around these areas so people have access. And I think, you know, we want to be able to go into, like, these. There's some trailheads that go off. It would hopefully be state land and the Forest Service land. We want to make sure those trailheads are accessible. There's, you know, there's a place for people, you know, to use a restroom or put their trash, make sure the trailheads are nice. We'd want to be able to do that. So I think what we want to do is I'd use the word enhancements,
because okay.
We're not going to develop that area. I just, it that would go against everything, you know, that this history's told us about this area.
What about roads? Does that change?
No,
when
and
you
that's
say access,
question.
Are we talking about a road?
No, the present, I mean, the place that people are really focused on now is not so much 14A, the major highway going through the canyon. What they're looking at is, you know, the Forest Service 222 road, which is up to Tenton Road. It goes up Little Spearfish. And, you know, you've had people say, well, you're gonna pave it and you're going to bring in big motorhomes. No, I think we do have to pay attention, though. The first mile or two going up to Rough Rock Falls. We need to do something as far as build it, whether we can grade that better. I'm not saying we're going to pave it. We need to do something so then people actually keep their hubcaps on their tires and people can expect to make it up without losing a muffler. Mm. And so that's a type of enhancement that I envision.
Let's go ahead and get to a different topic. Let's talk about hunting in South Dakota. That's a huge part of Game, Fish, and Parks. And and is this also how your department is partially funded as well, correct?
It is. If you go back, in fact, we're going to have some discussions from the appropriators, I think, on Tuesday morning. And we have, in total, between Parks and Wildlife, we have $91 million. And within that $91 million, you know, true operations for our admin people and some of the parks is around, you know, maybe $2.5 to $3 million. So $3 million of GF is that. Outside of that, then it's user fees, whether it's park entrance fees on the park side or it's people buying licenses and excise taxes on guns and ammo and different things on the wildlife side. So we truly are user-driven agency, much different than a lot of other agencies.
Does South Dakota still have the hunting culture that we've had in previous years to really sustain your department and its funding accordingly?
Absolutely. That's a great question, too, because that's just one. If you look around the nation, you'll see the number of people participating in hunting is going down. As become more and more people drawn into the cities, we're losing people out of the rural areas. But, you know, we have a strong, it's a land legacy, I'd say, you know, with our ranchers and our farmers, as well as our people, our hunters. And that, you know, I'm proud to say that legacy is still very strong. We see a lot of participation in the state, thank God.
How important is that to state wildlife management then, hunting? I don't hunt, so put it into perspective for me how that all sort of is interwoven.
You know, hunting has provided the money to probably have what I consider one of the greatest conservation successes in the world, really. It started back in 1937 when we started the natural legislation setting aside money out of excise taxes on guns and also where we put our hunting, our license sales. And that's allowed us to do, I mean, the habitat improvements that you see now, the access to some of these lands that you see now, our predator control, I think that in combination, you know, working closely with our commission and the legislature, all those things add up to a formula of success in conservation. But that partnership has to, and that's a partnership. That isn't done by us. It's not necessarily just done by the hunters. That's done by the landowners and those legislators. And so without that there, it'd really, really be difficult. And we'd be over across the street, and we'd be arguing for GF at the same time. But boy, that's difficult when you want to look at, you know, what we need for schools and some of the other things. And so fortunately, we're not into that discussion.
If you're just joining us, you're in the moment on South Dakota Public Broadcasting Radio. My guest is Kelly Hepler, Secretary of South Dakota's Game, Fish, and Parks Department. And Secretary Hepler, I'm wondering, what does your department do to sort of bring that next generation of hunters and anglers in to the community? Does that happen just organically with landowners and hunters in the state, or is that something that we also work to develop?
I think it's both. You know, we have these mentoring programs, which is great. You know, we have what's, I think, is a very enviable program also. We, you know, we give these youth tags out, and so we want people to go take our youth out and go hunting on lands, and we have great success with that. You know, we have an incredible number of volunteers or hunter ed people around the state that will go in and actually start working with their youth, teach them how to shoot, teach them how to hunt, and take them out. Those are all success stories. And, you know, it's easier to do it in, like, say, in a state like we're in right now because we have access to some of those lands and we still have the animals around to do that in. But it's multifaceted, you know. I'll just pick out one. Jason Cool runs a program. He has a gal working for him by the name of Maggie Lindsay. You know, Maggie will go work with these kids and her eyes just light up. I mean, she's so sincere. You know, and it's just neat because that just draws those kids and want to go out and hunting. And it's just not the kids, you know. We go out and we have, you know, becoming an outdoor women. So we bring women into the fold if they weren't raised in that culture, or maybe they're a single parent or something. You can bring them in the same way. So we have a combination of programs to do that, and they're heartwarming, and they're kind of the heartbeat of what we try to do.
One of our freshman lawmakers was talking about mountain lion hunting, and I'm wondering, is that a season? And if so, how's it going? That's what he was out doing when we were trying to reach him to talk about his priorities for Pierre.
You know, what a neat thing. When I left in the 70s, we didn't have elk coming back into the Black Hills yet or not. We didn't have mountain lions. There were some across the line over in the Wyoming. So when I come back, I mean, this, you know, reality changes. You know, I know people think, I mean, nothing changes, but things absolutely change all the time. And so to be able to hunt a mountain lion is pretty impressive. We do have a license. We do have a season form. you can use dogs in Custer State Park. We have a pretty good handle on the number of animals. We want to be sure that, it doesn't get exceeded as far as a harvest. But people, what they'll do is that, you get this nice snow you've been having. They can actually walk down a line and actually hunt it that way, and it's pretty impressive. And there's some, really trophies, and people are real excited about it. But it's a unique opportunity. You don't see a lot of lion hunting across the country. So the people that get these lions really are happy with them. They view them truly as a trophy animal.
What kind of numbers do we see?
I think there's like 150 to 170, and I'm sure my biologists would probably cringe when I get these numbers. I think they're pretty close. And so I think we're looking, we don't want to exceed the harvest. We look at all of them, the females, the subadults, and I think it's around 50 to 60 harvested a year is what we're trying to do.
You've been listening to Kelly Hepler, Secretary of the South Dakota State Game, Fish, and Parks. Secretary Hepler, thank you so much for your time today. We really appreciate it.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Coming up after the break, NOVA presents the nuclear option. We'll talk about climate change, catastrophe, and reinventing nuclear technology. You're in the moment, SDPB Radio. Welcome back to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. Tonight on SDPB TV, tune in for a new NOVA special called The Nuclear Option. 5 years after the earthquake and tsunami that triggered unprecedented meltdowns at the Fukushima nuclear power plant, scientists and engineers struggle to control an ongoing crisis. Yet, a new generation of nuclear power seems poised to emerge from the ashes. Joining us for a conversation about NOVA's special, The Nuclear Option, we have NOVA producer Miles Bryan calling in from Boston, Massachusetts. Miles, welcome to In the Moment.
Pleasure to be with you, Lori.
Thanks for joining us. You've been reporting on the disaster at Fukushima Daiichi since it happened. Give me an idea of what your interest was in this in the beginning.
I come to the nuclear power story with a strong background in aviation and aerospace. And interestingly, when you look at both endeavors, there's a lot of parallels. They are big, complicated, high-tech operations. They generally work at a very high level of safety, but when something goes wrong, it goes wrong in a very spectacular way. And in each case, nuclear power and airline aviation matches that. And so I guess that interest that I had in flying and understanding the technology of flying and spacecraft made me naturally interested in nuclear power. And so when Fukushima happened, March 11th, 2011, I had already put in work plans to go actually to Chernobyl to do some stories about what had happened in the exclusion zone there 25 years after the accident there. And then Fukushima happened, and that sent me down a very long road of going to Japan frequently and understanding what it's like to be on the inside of such an epic mess.
Give us, for people whose memory does not go back to that five-year earthquake and tsunami, give me a quick history lesson, which really needs to be put into context of Japan and how they use power.
Yes. Well, Japan, going into Fukushima, had 52 operative nuclear reactors. About 30% of their electricity came from nukes. They had aggressive plans to grow that well beyond 50%. For comparison, about 20% of our power in the U.S. is generated by nuclear. The earthquake and tsunami on March 11th changed everything there. It was magnitude 9 earthquake, epic earthquake, caused this 45-foot high walls of water that deluged the Fukushima Daiichi plant, undermining key safety systems and their backups, leading to triple meltdowns there. And today in Japan, there are only two operative nuclear reactors. The rest remain shut down as a result of public concern and fear over nuclear power.
The site now, what is it like? You've been there, you visited. Tell me what it's like to sort of walk into that space and what is being happened now. What is
the experience begins, several miles away when you go into what's called the exclusion zone. And it's absolutely apocalyptic in the literal sense that time has stood still at that time on March 11th in 2011. And in many cases, people simply left their lives and never went back. And so driving through that is a positively surreal experience and chilling and frightening to the bone when you go into a town and there's just nothing except the occasional wild boar, which they tend to roam the streets since they're now the top dog, if it were, to mix my metaphors. And then as you get closer to the plant, layer upon layer of security and ultimately layer upon layer of clothing just to get in to protect yourself, full-face respirators, triple gloves, triple socks, Tyvek suits. And then you get in there, and as you walk around the plant doing the best you can to shoot without contaminating your gear, which is a challenge on its own right, because you want to have it all strapped and bagged and so forth, you have a monitor with you. And they've got the Geiger counter is going, and it's making noise, and you get to certain places, and almost, it seems random to me, it must be somewhat random, it'll start spiking. And your radiation monitor will tell you it is now time to go, and you don't question that. Believe me, you do not question.
Oh, my.
Yeah.
And what kind of work is being done there still? There's still workers
well,
there gearing
yeah,
up.
Yeah, no, it's the cleanup there will take at least 40 years.
Wow.
40 years. It's a mind-boggling thing when you think about it. To decommission three melted-down plants is an, you know, no one has ever done this. We don't really know how long it's going to take. They've estimated 40 years. There's about 5,000 workers there every day. They're all in these suits. It's like going on a spacewalk to go back to my space days. And it's they work under very difficult conditions and yet tirelessly making progress to clean it up as best they can. It's a big job, though.
Are there lessons from a Chernobyl, or we can go back to the 70s and Three Mile Island? How do these all intersect, these three sort of well-known and well-named disaster areas?
Well, I think what you have to think about is, you know, our root causes of these events. Chernobyl, I'm going to put that off as kind of an outlier because that was a design that was embraced by Russia, a graphite reactor that was not widely used in the West because it was considered unsafe. It had no containment structure, and it was run in a very reckless manner by a crew that did a test that was not advised. So let's put that one off to the side as just a complete artifact of the great Soviet Empire, for lack of a better way of describing it.
Sure.
Now, when you look at Three Mile Island, that's instructive because what you had there was an event that seemed a lot scarier than it was. It actually occurred about 2 weeks after the release of a movie, The China Syndrome, mm-hmm. which you may recall, which starring Jane Fonda, Michael Douglas, and they actually really in a prescient way told the story of a meltdown at a California nuclear power plant, fictional, with a greedy corporation and so forth. And so when Three Mile Island happened, we were already a little bit scared about nuclear, but then we had seen the movie, and so we assumed that the worst was happening. And so what the lesson there is that a lot of times our fears far transcend the reality when it comes to radiation. Radiation scares us in a way that other things don't for reasons that we could go into. Hmm. The thing to think about at Fukushima, which was surprising to me, I went into it, I wanted to do a film on the cleanup. And when I got there, I realized, as much as anything, this is a story about how the fear of nuclear has the counterintuitive effect of making it less safe. Basically, what happens is, We invested heavily in nuclear in the 70s, and we haven't iterated the technology as we should because we sort of walked away from it. And there's a lot of ways to make it safer that would have made Fukushima impossible to happen. And we didn't necessarily embrace those ideas and those safety measures because of our ambivalent feelings about nuclear.
Hmm. One of your guests says that we got freaked out. In the 70s, just says it like it is. We got freaked out.
Yeah.
So are you suggesting that we shouldn't be as freaked out? What happens next? What happens post? Let's get to the rising from the ashes part of this. And what are scientists and engineers looking at now that would give us hope?
Well, if you look at it through the prism of climate change and concern about climate change, if you put that among your top concerns, it's one of the things I worry about. And not everybody I know feels that way, but that it's a big issue in my view. And we have to come up with ways to meet our energy demand that are not impacting our climate. When you do the back of the napkin calculations on wind and solar, it's not going to get us there, at least not yet. I mean, someday I think we'll come up with a way of storing and distributing wind and solar in a way that can run industrial economies. But in the meantime, nuclear is right there on the shelf and available to us in a way that does not produce greenhouse gases. And if we spent a little bit of time thinking about that and getting real and getting over being freaked out and looking at some ways to make it safer than it was at Fukushima and in some of these older plants, I think we would be better off in the fight against climate change. It's certainly a bridge to a renewable future, I think, and I think it's something we should not discount.
Will we ever believe that it's safe enough?
You know, its safety is relative. You know, we don't think so much about the dangers involved in pulling coal out of the ground or the dangers involved in oil wells that can blow up or refineries that cause problems or the air pollution created by fossil fuel products. All those things, when you start adding them up, I believe at the bottom of the ledger, you'll find many more casualties associated with the fossil fuel production than nuclear. But nuclear, again, because it's this, you know, invisible, scary thing which has links to bombs, after all, makes us frightened in a way that, you know, we would accept an explosion at a fossil fuel plant as just another day. If you have an explosion at a nuclear plant, that is global news for years. So there's something about it that's different, and it's like most things, if you approach it and engineer it right, you can make it safe enough. The real question is, more than anything, is can you make it cost-effective enough when the alternative is fracked natural gas, which is very inexpensive right now.
So the wind and solar proponents say that's not scary at all. So the challenge there is storage and the grid, as I understand it, is that we can't store it and use it in a way that will give us what we need. Do I understand that correctly?
That is exactly right. Electricity is the one commodity we use instantaneously. It has no shelf life. The grid is, you know, we have generators that are powering your lights at this moment, and there's no storage capacity in the grid, very little. Until we figure out, you know, because we can't count on steady wind and sunny days, until we can figure out how to make store that and have it available when we want it, it is not practical in large scale. It's good on the margins right now, and eventually we will come up with storage regimes. I'm convinced of that. There's plenty of good reasons to do it. But for now, it isn't there yet.
Is the nuclear technology ahead of the storage technology for wind and solar?
Well, it is, because we have nuclear plants that, you know, we can build them tomorrow, and we know how to do that.
Right.
They're expensive, though. And really, you know, the most important thing that people need to be thinking about is, if we really want to reimagine the infrastructure we have to create energy here in this country and all over the world, you have to think about somehow putting a cost on carbon itself. You know, in society, in economies, we tax the bad things. If you accept for the moment that carbon dioxide is a bad thing for the atmosphere, as it is scientifically proven, then maybe that's something we should assign a cost to. And once that happens, all of a sudden, things like nuclear and solar and wind, as a matter of fact, become much more advantageous relative to fossil fuels.
If you're just joining us, you're in the moment on SDPB Radio. My guest is Nova producer Miles O'Brien. Tonight on SDPB TV, you can tune in for a new Nova special. It's called The Nuclear Option. And Miles, I'm wondering about the protests in Japan. There were folks talking there who had lived in that area and been evacuated, thought they were going to be able to go home. They're not for building more nuclear plants or reactivating those plants in Japan. I'm not quite sure how to say that. What are you hearing from the Japanese citizens about this?
They are 70% to 80% opposed to going back into nuclear power, and it's a traumatized populace. There's no question about it, and completely understandable. But a lot of it has to do with the way the accident played out and the way the utility, TEPCO, and the government managed the information flow. They weren't candid. They tried to stonewall. They tried to hide things early on. And once you convince people that you're lying or not being forthcoming, it's very difficult to convince them that you've turned over a new leaf. And so there's a huge, huge chasm of trust that has been breached in Japan between the nuclear complex and people. And couple that with the fact that they've been able to fire up their fossil fuel plants and fill them with liquefied natural gas, fracked natural gas, and keep their economy going without paying a huge cost, because it is cheap right now. That equation can change very quickly, and Japan does not have fossil fuel resources. It has no natural resources of its own. It has very minimal solar and wind because of its geography, and it's not an ideal wind place. So they have some. They're very limited on where they can go to power their industrial economy, and that's why they had spent so much time and effort on nuclear. Will people ever come back around to that? I think as long as their economy is going well and the lights are staying on and there's no brownouts, they're probably going to continue to oppose nuclear power. Over time, however, those things can change, and it will be interesting to see how it plays out. But for now, it's very, very much a dead issue.
You said safety is relative. How safe can these be? You also mentioned that there were safety features that could have been perhaps prevented what happened at Fukushima. What would those have been? We've got just like a minute left.
Basically, a plant like that needs to be connected to electricity in order to safely shut down. And if you lose that connection, you need lots of backups for that, generators and batteries. But the tsunami wiped out the generators and batteries. That all could have been avoided by placing the batteries and generators in better places, or by just upgrading the plant and coming up with a nuclear plant, which are available now and being built now, that can last much longer without power if they're shut down. And that is not rocket science. That is off-the-shelf technology, and it's something we should be looking at.
How much is America pushing for this technology?
Not much at all. We have four plants being built right now, and it's not really part of the discussion. And that's part of why I wanted to do this film. I want people to at least think about this as one of the alternatives as we look toward converting our energy supply system.
Miles O'Brien is a producer for NOVA. The program is The Nuclear Option. It's a presentation by NOVA tonight. You can see it SDPB-TV at 8 p.m. Central, 7 Mountain. And Miles could have explained all the science, because I watched this and the science is very clear. So tune in to see how it all works.
So much.
I didn't make you have
You've
to
made
do
my
that.
Day.
Thanks for clearing it up and helping us figure it out, as NOVA always does. Miles O'Brien, thanks so much.
You're welcome, Laurie.